All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm calling to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And we will start by calling the roll. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, if you are here, please call the roll.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Eklund, present.
Thacker. Thacker. Bonner. Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dameth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Hello.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Heel. Heel. Morrison.
Present.
Munson.
Present.
Pryor. Pryor. Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott. Wolgamott.
Present.
Wolgamott, present. All right, I will go back to Backer. Bonner.
And I believe Bonner is excused.
Okay. Keel and Pryor. A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. Okay. Thank you, members. So at the first order of business, of course, is to approve the minutes of February 1st. I know you've all taken a look at those. Is there a motion to approve?
Motion to approve. Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Bierman moves to approve the minutes of February 1st. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Is there any discussion? And I think this is one set of minutes where there's a roll call recorded. So just for the new members, when we have those, you do want to check to make sure that your vote is recorded correctly. So seeing no discussion, please unmute yourselves. All those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
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 All opposed, please say no. And the motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you very much.
You're leaving?
Yes, and Representative Backer is present.
Thank you. Yes, I had a technical hiccup. I'm on.
All right, thank you. And I think that we also have Representative Pryor, so she will be noted in the minutes as well. Okay, thank you. And we know those things happen, no worries. Okay, so today, members, we're not doing any bills today, but we're having an overview of a really important topic, how we buy healthcare for people on our public programs in Minnesota. And as you've seen from our overviews that we've had so far, we spend a lot of money in this area. And so I think it's really important for us as members of the legislature to understand what's going on in this area so that we can, act on behalf of our constituents to make sure that our money is well spent and that the folks that we're providing care for are getting the best possible care. We have Matt Anderson from the Department of Human Services, and he's going to start us off today. So welcome, Commissioner Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you this afternoon. As Chair Liebling said, my name is Matt Anderson. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare and State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. With me today is Ann Bobbs, who will be helping with the slides. And we also have other staff that are available for questions as we get into the discussion. So as we pull up the slides, you can move to the second slide. As we're looking at the Department of Human Services and our Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance, or sometimes called Medicaid programs. We purchase our healthcare through these programs in a few different ways. First of all, we have our fee-for-service program. This is the program that serves about 25% of our enrollees. When I talk about enrollees, we have about 1.3 million people in Minnesota that get their health coverage through one of our programs. So about 25% of them are in fee-for-service. This is where DHS is processing the claims and paying providers directly for each service they provide to our enrollees. The second and certainly largest category is our managed care population. This is 75% of our enrollees, and we pay 8 managed care organizations a monthly capitation amount on a per enrollee basis. And then they design provider networks and pay provider claims for the services that their enrollees receive through that. Both of these, both fee-for-service and managed care, are also in a innovative purchasing strategy called Integrated Health Partnerships, or IHPs. This is where DHS contracts with provider organizations and sets out expectations both in terms of quality and in terms of total spending for those provider organizations to coordinate and provide care for the population that is attributed to them, the population that they serve most often. And with that, if they meet those targets and objectives, they have the opportunity to receive bonus or cost sharing savings with those providers. And that cuts across both the fee-for-service and managed care populations. So from the provider's perspective, it is about all of their enrollees in Medicaid or Minnesota Care, not whether or not the person is in fee-for-service or managed care, because from the provider's perspective, how they treat that patient and the incentives that they have should all be aligned. And so that's an effort to try to align those. We have about a third of our population that receives most of their care from one of our integrated healthcare partnerships. Next slide. So as we talk about our managed care organizations, again, we contract with managed care organizations. These are both health plans, names that you're familiar with, like Blue Plus, Medica, Health Partners, UCare. And we also contract with county-based purchasing programs. These are plans that counties have elected either individually or in collaboration with one another to operate a plan for their Medicaid and Minnesota Care enrollees in the counties that they serve. We contract with these organizations to deliver services on behalf of our enrollees. They develop provider networks, so they decide which providers they want to contract with. They negotiate payment arrangements with those providers, including incentive arrangements or fee-based arrangements. They also do care coordination and disease management, especially for enrollees that have complex conditions or chronic care conditions. We also have then as part of these contracts and arrangements, we have oversight of the managed care organizations with whom we contract. And this includes financial oversight. The MCOs submit quarterly financial reports, including income statements. Those are reviewed by our actuary, independent actuary, that reviews those. They submit an annual medical loss ratio report for us to verify and submit to CMS. So that's required as part of our arrangement with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That federal agency oversees our programs and our arrangements for those programs. And in return, we get federal matching funds on our Medicaid program, as well as subsidies for the Minnesota Care program through the federal basic health program subsidies. We also have contract oversight of our managed care organizations in terms of the terms and conditions in which we've contracted with them and what they're going to provide as a part of that contracting process. This includes quality work plans, quality improvement activities, program integrity areas, those kinds of things. And then we also offer the services of our ombudsman. We have an ombudsman for state managed care programs. This ombudsman in the Department of Human Services works directly with enrollees to help them navigate their care and advocate on their behalf for fair and equal treatment by managed care organizations to help resolve problems they may be having, situations that occur between as they transition between providers or as they transition from one managed care organization to another, whatever frustration or issues they may be having, to help bring those to resolution so that the enrollees are able to get the care and the services for which our programs cover and are intending for our enrollees to be able to receive. Through this oversight, of course, there are areas that we continue to have frustration and we know that members of this committee have had frustration with as well, where there's information that isn't public to us or that we don't have clear sight lines on. Yesterday, I was before the committee talking about federal laws that prohibit us from releasing or being able to really get a clear picture of pharmacy prices, for example, and arrangements with pharmacy benefit managers that our managed care organizations subcontract with. We have transparency or oversight gaps where it's difficult for us to be able to tell in our managed care organizations or to be able to compare them on an apples to apples basis in terms of their administrative costs or efficiencies, those kinds of things. And just wanted to acknowledge that while we are always looking for ways to ensure that we are good stewards of the public resources and exercising appropriate oversight, that we don't always have clear lines of sight or all the information that we would like to be able to have available or that would be able to be able to answer every question that we may have. Next slide. So when we're talking about managed care organizations and the population that we serve, I want to be clear with the 75% of our enrollees who are covered through managed care, who are we talking about? So first is families and children. This is the largest category of enrollment in Minnesota Care and Medicaid. As you can see here in the statistics, almost a million people of the 1.3 million people that we cover in our programs are in the families and children's category. They are fairly evenly split between Greater Minnesota and the seven county metropolitan area. Although from a population percentage basis, if you're looking at a proportion of the population, the Greater Minnesota population is a larger percentage of the Greater Minnesota population is in Minnesota Care or Medicaid. Adults without disabilities, far smaller population, at 60,000, and this population tends to be more of this population tends to live in the seven county metro area than in Greater Minnesota. And the third category is our seniors population. These are mostly what are referred to as dual eligible enrollees. In other words, they're eligible for our Medicaid program because they are low income and seniors, but because they're seniors, they're also enrolled in Medicare. And the arrangement between Medicare and Medicaid is that Medicare is the first payer. If it covers a service, that's the payment, that's where the provider gets paid. Medicaid pays for services only if they are not covered by Medicare. And so most particularly this involves long-term care, some residential or rehab kinds of services. And so Medicaid is the largest payer of long-term care services in the state, largely because of our dual enrollee population. When we're looking at these populations across, again, I should say with seniors, the opposite is true with adults with disabilities. For seniors, more of our seniors live in Greater Minnesota than in the metro area. When you're looking at these populations, again, the families and children by far the largest group, but on a per capita basis, much smaller spending. And so in our programs across the board, adults with disabilities and seniors account for a larger proportion of the total spending in our programs. Next slide. So within our managed care programs, we procure, issue requests for proposals for managed care organizations and for these contracts. This is an exercise, a very important exercise in order to be able to help make sure that we are both good stewards of the public's resources, but also getting the best possible care and services for our enrollees. So why do we re-procure the MCO contracts? First, as federal law requires us, if a Medicaid program is going to use managed care as an option, federal law requires that there be a competitive procurement in selecting which managed care organizations are going to get a contract. Likewise, state law requires that we re-procure these contracts every 5 years. As I said, procurement offers a way for us to be able to ensure that we are promoting highest quality care at the best value by creating a competition and being able to evaluate proposals from different plans sort of head-to-head. We are able to make sure that we are contracting with the organizations that are able to provide the best service at the lowest cost for our enrollees. And then, of course, just from administrative perspective, as Chair Liebling said, we spend a large amount of both state and federal money on these contracts, more than $5 billion annually. And so it's appropriate for us as an agency to be able to make sure that we're using that money wisely and that we are exercising the appropriate oversight. And procurement is one of the ways that we're able to help do that. Next slide. So last month, on January 4th, we released a request for proposals for the families and children eligibility category, again, the largest category of enrollees for the 7-county metropolitan area. This RFP was developed in a new process that we started last spring. DHS, in partnership with the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, convened a work group. We were going to start earlier in the year. That got disrupted by COVID and the pandemic, but we reconvened online in May and began exploring changes that we'd like to make in our procurement process and how to build a process that was a greater partnership, a more embodiment of a partnership between DHS and our county partners. That culminated in the fall, and we transitioned that group to a more focused group of DHS staff and representatives from each of the 7-county metro counties that were going to be part of this RFP, or the region that was going to be affected by the RFP. And so the RFP really reflects DHS and those representatives from the 7-county metro area coming together to jointly develop what the RFP was going to be and score the proposals together. And I want to emphasize that in the past, DHS's process in our work with counties has largely been more segmented. DHS created some questions, counties created other questions, DHS scored our questions, counties scored their questions, and then the results were combined to be able to select which plans we're going to be contracting. So this process is significantly different in that there is no set of state questions and county questions. There's only one set of questions. It was developed by both of us. There's only one scoring methodology developed by both of us. And we will be scoring together at the table together, probably virtually, but at the table together coming up with the scoring of those proposals. You'll also see in the request for proposals, they significantly reflect the shared DHS and county priorities around better health, fuller lives, more equitable outcomes, and lower cost growth for our enrollees. And so within the request for proposals, you'll see a heavy emphasis on addressing social determinants of health, of addressing longstanding disparities in health outcomes, of community engagement and enrollee engagement, and how plans propose to share decision-making with enrollees. So we're very excited about this new process. We're very excited about the RFP that was developed that came out of it. We had the vendors respondents conference last week where they could ask questions, and we'll be providing written responses to those. We have a website if you want to follow any of the information about the proposal process. Responses, once they come in, again, we will be scoring those with the 7-county metro area, and then we anticipate awarding contracts to the successful MCOs in May. Next slide. So this is just one step. It's a very big step, but it's one step in a sequence of procurements that we're going to be doing. So January was the RFP for the metro area children's and families contracts for both Medicaid and Minnesota Care. That contract will go into effect on January 22nd. this October, this coming October, we'll release another RFP, and that will be a statewide RFP, and that will be for contracts for our seniors and special needs populations. That RFP will go out in October, will be scored early next year, and those contracts will begin in 2023. Next January, we will issue our third RFP, and that will be for the children's and families populations in Medicare and, or in Medicaid and Minnesota Care. And those contracts will also begin in January 2023. So this is a cycle where we issue multiple RFPs and procure contracts in different regions of the state and for the different populations that we serve. Next slide. I mentioned early in the presentation about our integrated health partnerships, and these are contracts with provider groups where they have incentives to provide care at higher quality and lower cost for the enrollees that they serve. I want to provide a little bit more information for you about this innovative program, first of its kind in the country. We have 27 integrated health partnerships that serve more than 400,000 Minnesotans across the state. 47% of the enrollees served by IHPs live in Greater Minnesota. There are more than 500 different provider locations, so providers that have multiple clinics and hospitals and service areas, and they represent more than 10,000 individual clinicians who are providing care. So this has been a successful program and one that we're very proud of in the sense that it breaks a lot of the barriers, both for providers in the way that they manage care for their enrollees, and as well as for DHS in the way that we pay for care across both our fee-for-service system and our managed care programs to be able to align those incentives. Next slide. I mentioned alignment of incentives and consistency for providers. One of the biggest challenges they have in moving forward on incentive-based payment arrangements has been that their population is fragmented. They have some in Medicare, some in commercial plans, and all kinds of different plans, and then some in Minnesota Care, some in Medicaid. By doing this, each IHP has beneficiaries from about between five and eight managed care organizations that they may serve. By participating in the integrated healthcare program, they now have a single contract with DHS that aligns their incentives, provides data support, accountability metrics across their entire population. So regardless of which of those five or eight plans an enrollee may have selected for their coverage, it's going to be the quality and payment incentives are going to be aligned. And so it allows them to be much more consistent and confident in the way that they design their care and provide their care. It also creates the ability to get to a critical mass. And this is significant. The notion of critical mass is significant as we talk about payment arrangements, particularly those that include some element of financial risk. If we were only contracting for fee-for-service and only for 25% of our population, it would be very difficult for our providers to get to a point where they had enough enrollees under those incentives to be able to feel confident about any kind of financial risk that they would take or the quality measures that they would be held accountable to. But by being able to combine both our managed care and fee-for-service populations, we're now able to rise up to a much larger number of enrollees and many more payments and claims that allow providers then to be able to be much more confident in the trends and in their ability as they make care decision and delivery system changes to be able to track those changes and see how they're impacting their overall performance. Calculation is also very important as we talk about critical mass on the DHS side. It's also very important for us as we're calculating performance, both in terms of cost and quality, to be able to have enough enrollees involved to be confident in our own measures of how individual delivery systems are performing and whether or not we're really achieving our goals. Next slide. This graph shows some of the financial performance of integrated healthcare partnerships over the years since their inception. In total, the program has saved the state in our Medicaid and Minnesota Care programs has saved a total of $400 million. Our 2019 results are still interim because we're still going through the calculations, and we'll need to true those up as we get more claims data in. But initially, the individual results across our IHPs varied quite a bit, from IHP that lost up to $17 million, that was 5% above its spending target, all the way to another IHP that was almost 10% below its spending target and will receive an $11.5 million shared savings bonus as a result. IHP's targets are reset every 3 years, requiring them to thereby continually beat their performance to be able to show that they are producing year-over-year savings and not just a one-time benefit. Even the IHPs that I mentioned, the IHP that lost $17 million because it went 5% above its spending target, even that IHP, when looking over the years of its performance in the program, has a net savings. In other words, it has ended up saving and collecting more money through the program than its losses in any particular year. And that's in any kind of risk-based arrangement, that is the incentive for providers. It's not that the shared savings are going to be guaranteed, but rather that by continuous improvement and performance over the years, the good years will outweigh the bad years, and you will continue to improve. So, Madam Chair, that is the presentation that I have. Like I said, we do have staff from DHS that are available to provide more information or answer questions. I'm happy to respond with anything that I know, respect your prerogative as to how you'd like the rest of the hearing to proceed.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. That was a good, really good start for us. And I see we already have three members with questions, but before we get to them, I just want to ask a couple of, and I have a bunch of questions too, but I'm not going to really ask my involved questions. I'm going to let them ask first, but I just wanted to just clarify a couple things and go back a little bit. So first of all, we have this 25% in fee-for-service, 75% in managed care. How does somebody get into one or the other of those groups? Who's in fee-for-service, who's in managed care? Are there differences in those populations? Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So most of the, generally speaking, whether someone is in fee-for-service or in managed care is largely going to be determined by their eligibility category. So under federal law, the Minnesota Care Program, our basic health care program, federal law requires that that be administered through managed care organizations. So almost everyone in Minnesota Care by federal law is in a managed care program. We do have a very, very small number of people who are in fee-for-service because their enrollment started before they were able to select the plan, and you know maybe they had a claim or two that was they received services before their plan period actually began, and we pay that fee-for-service. But generally speaking, everybody in Minnesota Care, as a matter of federal law, is going to be in a managed care organization. Likewise, all of the Medicaid expansion population, these are adults without dependent children who earn less than 138% of the federal poverty line, are in managed care. Almost all the families and children are in managed care. Seniors and those with disabilities have, although seniors are usually in managed care as well, people with disabilities have more flexibility to be able to opt out of managed care and to be able to select to be in the fee-for-service program. But ultimately, the factors of whether someone is in fee-for-service or managed care is largely going to depend on what basis they have eligibility for the program in the first place. And then that is going to put them into either a mandatory managed care arrangement, or if they have the option, they'll be able to choose whether they want to be in fee-for-service.
Okay, thank you for that answer. So as I said, I have more questions, but I'm gonna let members ask and see if they might have the same ones I do. I don't know, I'm really interested to see what members are wanting to know. Representative Grunhagen, and then we have Ryer and Pryor.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Anderson, for the presentation. You know, just back to the managed care, it looks like we have about 1 million people there, and there's always been kind of a bone of contention as far as reimbursement rates. Now, we do have a statute that requires the 25 most regular medical procedures at a clinic, they do have to post their reimbursement rate. I mean, I've gone up to my local clinic and it's listed there. You have to look for it. It's in a glass case. But, you know, at least we've got that. But on the other hand, couldn't you take to see, you know, there's a question of these reimbursement rates and what happens. And couldn't you take the total amount of participants, let's just say 1 million, divided by your cost to get it down to a per individual basis, and then compare with other states what their per participant cost is. And that would at least give us a some type of comparative value if we're over funding it, underfunding it, or where we're at as far as the grid. Maybe there's already that, I'm not sure. But I mean, is that possible at all, since they claim that reimbursement, the managed care claims that reimbursement is proprietary information. I'm trying to get at it another way, that at least we can do some type of assessment. Your thoughts, Mr. Anderson?
So, Representative Grunhagen, I think that's a great question, and I think you're trying to get to the broad question, and I'll just frame it up a bit here because we haven't really been talking yet in this presentation about how much the managed care organizations pay to the providers of the service. And I just want to point out that's what you're aiming at here. And I just want to point out too that DHS does get to know how much they're paying, I believe. It's only we and the rest of the public who don't. So anyway, I'll let Mr. Anderson now try to attack that question if he can.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen. We can do analytics around how much we spend per enrollee versus how other states spend per enrollee. One of the challenges we have is there are only two states that offer a basic health program like Minnesota Care. Minnesota and New York, our programs are different, and so it's a little difficult to compare apples to apples in that way, the mini apple and the big apple, I guess. There's not a lot of data around the country with that population. With our Medicaid population, obviously every state has a Medicaid program, but they are vastly different in their eligibility requirements and who they're willing to extend coverage to, what benefits they have within those programs, and then the provider payment rates that are paid within their communities. And so there's so much variation and so many different moving pieces that those kind of analyses often don't quite get to the real question that people are looking for around whether or not you're getting the best value for your dollar in the Medicaid program, and whether or not it's being used most effectively to improve people's health. Those kind of analyses are things that like I said, that we have data and we are able to do some of those comparisons, but the value of those comparisons can be limited depending on the question.
Representative Grunhagen, any follow-up?
You know, in the age of analytics and technology, you would think that we'd be able to do a pretty good comparison with states that have a similar program. It's just hard for me to believe that that's not possible, but I'll defer to Mr. Anderson on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And that kind of comes to one of my questions, which is, you, Mr. Anderson, you talked about the procurement and the quality scores and all those metrics, but you didn't say whether you're going to be doing procurement on price. Are the plans going to be competing on price also in this one or not?
Madam Chair, in the procurement that we released here in January for the Children's and Families contract in the Seven County metro area, we are not putting a price bid as part of that procurement. In other words, DHS will set an actuarially sound rate for those contracts. This is largely because of the disruption of COVID-19 in our healthcare system as a whole. And so asking plans to use their most recent data and the uncertainty in our markets today to put forward price bids would potentially result in either plans putting forward bids that they ultimately wouldn't be able to afford because they couldn't predict the cost ramifications of utilization and price in such a tumultuous environment, or conversely, that they would be getting windfalls because all of them, you know, as they look at their risk and think, you know, we don't know what's going on, so we're going to, you know, up the price more and end up having a bid situation in which we are actually agreeing to monthly capitation rates that exceed what the actual costs are going to be. So we are working with our actuary to try to figure out how best to manage that. We have contract updates on a regular basis after the contracts are signed to be able to factor in fluctuations in the market and to be able to look at those going forward. But this proposal and the responses that responders will be submitting will be based on quality and their plans for enrollee service, not on price.
Okay, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Your presentations are always very interesting. I appreciate the work you do. I have a quick question about procurement, and then mostly I have a question about IHPs, the Integrated Health Partnerships. On procurement, you say you're awarding contracts in May. How many get awarded? Is it everyone who's above, every plan that's above a certain level? Do you say we're going to take the top two or three per area? How do you decide who makes the cut? And maybe we could talk about that. And if I could follow up then with IHPs, that would be great.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative. So the number of plans selected in the procurement process will depend on, will vary by county. And so under federal law, with some exceptions, generally speaking, the general rule is that a county needs to have two managed care organizations so that enrollees have some choice. There are allowed exceptions in very smaller counties, rural counties, where if the state chooses, it can select a single plan. But the general rule is that you have to have at least two plans. The Seven County metro area where we're procuring, there will likely be more than two plans, or historically there have been more than two plans in Hennepin and Ramsey County and some of the suburbs. I don't know exactly off the top of my head how many each county has had in the past, but it's usually in the 2 to 4 range, and it's going to be based on population so that there's enough capacity and enough choice for people who live in the area to be able to make sure that they have provider networks that work best for them, that they have service that they feel confident about, or if they are transitioning between a commercial product and one of our plans, that they might be able to stay attached to the same managed care organization. And those are conversations that we have with counties. So as a matter of statute, counties are able to recommend to the commissioner how many plans they think are best for their population that they serve, and so we want to be able to take their input into account as well.
Representative Ryer,
thank you. Not on that, but just my question about integrated health partnerships. So we've got fee for service and managed care, and then the IHPs. So does each organization's fee schedule or capitation rate still apply to those providers within the IHP? So you have kind of a network, but then the overall gets calculated for incentives and performance measurements. Is that how that works?
Yeah, it's pretty confusing. Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, it can be confusing, but you're on exactly the right path. So we have fee-for-service rates, just a fee schedule. This is how much you get paid for this service, and we pay you for that. Managed care organizations negotiate a payment rate with providers separately, and so the provider gets paid that. In the IHP program, what we do is we combine all of those payments, whether from fee-for-service or managed care, and regardless of which managed care organization that the provider received over the year, and we say, based on all of that payment, did you stay within, above, or below the expected spending target? And then what's important in the way that the program really functions well is that then if a provider is above their quality measures and they kept their spending below their target, and so they're going to get a shared savings bonus, each of the managed care organizations under contract are required to pay their proportional rate of that bonus back to, because they're the ones that saved on lower utilization or on better outcomes for their enrollees. And so it is a complex mathematical exercise, but it is a whole system exercise. In other words, that we've captured the entire system, both fee-for-service and managed care, and we've captured it both on the expense side of the equation as well as on the shared savings or the bonus side of the equation.
Okay.
So, all right. Representative Ryer?
Yeah, do we have all of the large health systems? I mean, you talked about 500 locations, 10,000 practitioners, but do we have in the Metro Park, Nicollet, and Fairview, and the large ones that are participating? Because I would imagine that would drive a lot of savings. And then do these savings get used when we're budgeting for the next year at DHS for the budgets that we may see or that would come from the governor? And that was the end of my question. So thank you.
Okay, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the questions. They're excellent questions. So most of the large systems are participating at one level or another, and so this is the IHP initiative is a voluntary initiative. There's no mandate on a provider to participate if they don't want to. It's also on a request for proposal basis. So providers come to DHS with their proposal of what they think they can deliver for their enrollees, what services they think should be included or not included as we go about these areas. And so it varies a lot. So we have a collaborative of federally qualified health centers, and they've joined together, in sort of a virtual basis to say they want to be able to do integrated healthcare partnership for the people that they serve and the services that they provide. You have, as you mentioned, many of the large multi-hospital health systems participate, and they may participate in one geographic area, or they may participate as a system as a whole. Right now, you mentioned Park Nicollet in particular. The Park Nicollet Hospital is not participating in an IHP. The Sanford Health System in Southwest Minnesota is not participating in an IHP. I should say for clarity purposes, the Park Nicollet Hospital is not participating in IHP, but that is part of the Health Partners system. And Health Partners has joined with Allina in the Northwest metro area, and they have their own joint IHP. Again, a very unusual collaboration. We have an unusual collaboration in Northeast Minnesota, multiple otherwise independent hospitals and clinics that have joined together into a virtual collaborative to operate an IHP among themselves. And so it's one of the things that's been really interesting as these demonstration projects has evolved is how different providers find different relationships with one another, find different relationships across broad geographies, find different relationships within different patient populations. So we have one of our newest IHPs is called Altair, and it is really designed for people with disabilities, particularly intellectual and developmental disabilities, to be able to serve a very unique and high cost population, and to be able to do that in a way that again is looking at quality metrics and overall spending. So it really is a provider-driven relationship, and our team back at DHS works very hard with different provider groups to be able to figure out ways that work best for them and for the enrollee population that they serve.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Anderson. We've got a couple of members waiting. So thank you for your patience, Representative Pryor, and then Bierman.
Great. Well, thank you for the questions that came ahead of me. Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, Representative Breyer, because those were my questions. But fortunately, I still have more questions, which I'm sure you do too. So just, you know, just kind of as a higher level look at this, and if I could understand this better, I mean, when we talk about these IHPs, which is my interest right now, that I'd like to follow up on, is, I mean, you talk about the alignment of incentives, the data that supports it, accountability metrics, you know, so it seems like these are the kinds of things that, you know, we want to promote in healthcare in Minnesota, especially in our public programs. So, you know, these contracts that are coming out, is there like, does that mean that it's like all over once we give those contracts, you know, we can't do any more innovating, we can't do any more combining and partnerships? Or, you know, what are we doing now to promote or, and that there's a, to promote it. But then actually I should ask the question that's before that, which is these integrated health partnerships. It seems like there's lofty goals behind it of what we're trying to do. So I guess my first question that I'd like you to ask is, you know, are there measures that saying that this is something that's working and that, you know, that we are promoting better health in our population. So that actually is the question I'd like to hear first. And if there is something that says, yes, this is seems to have value in Minnesota, then my second question is, you know, what are we doing to expand the use of it and you know, get it out to more people or make it available to more people to sign up for these kinds of plans?
Okay, so there's a lot in there. And so Commissioner Anderson, I'm gonna let you, we're kind of running to the end of this segment, but here's what I wanna add a little question to that one. It's kind of a more foundational question, I would say. If you can add it to the pile there. If we have MCOs that are managing care for the people on these programs, why do we need to layer the IHP on top?
So these are all, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. These are all really great questions, and they really highlight some of the complexities in the system that we have, in the healthcare system that we have, and the way that the IHP program has developed and evolved over time as a way of trying to move and address some of the issues that are challenging in our healthcare system, and particularly around fragmentation. So the first thing I would say is, yes, we have data showing that since the inception of the Integrated Healthcare Partnership, we have data showing that quality of care measures have improved. In other words, that enrollees are either achieving better outcomes, or for measures where we're only able to measure a process measure, that providers are following the appropriate evidence-based process. We have been moving more and more toward outcome measures within the IHP program. And second, that the program has been growing. So I mentioned earlier, we now have 27 different IHPs all over the state. When the program began, we had six. And so we have been promoting it and growing it. It is a risk. There's a financial risk associated with becoming an IHP, and we don't want to shy away from that. So we need to, as we work with provider organizations that are interested in developing an IHP, of being able to work with them in advance, be able to share information with them, the data that we already have about their enrollees, so that they can better understand their enrollees and their care needs, and so that they can make an informed decision about how they want to design their IHP and the risk they want to take. We started in those first six IHPs, there was no downside risk at the beginning. There was only, if you save money and you earn your bonus, you get your bonus. But if your spending goes over the target, that there won't be a foul or a penalty at the beginning. But that beginning has to end, and it has now ended, and we are now moving IHPs where they now have downside risk as well. So if their spending goes over, as I mentioned earlier, they can have to pay money back into the program. And again, just like with the bonuses, that money back is split with the federal government and with managed care organizations as well, because the spending went above. And so this has been an evolving project. It continues to be a demonstration in which we continue to experiment with what works best and what works best with different provider groups. Not every provider group can be part of an IHP or can take on the risk of an IHP. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, but it's certainly one that as organizations come to us and say, we're interested in this, or we think that we know our population and can be able to take on some of this risk. It's one where our team, again, Heather Peterman and Matt Spahn and the team back at DHS really sit down and try to drill into how could we manage something that would work best for this provider group and most importantly for this enrollee group as to whatever that may be. Madam Chair, you asked about why managed care and then IHPs on top of it. And what I would say is that, again, as we look at a fragmented healthcare system with multiple payers, different delivery systems, one of the objectives of the IHP is to really get incentives aligned for providers so that they begin to redesign the care delivery system. What happens when an enrollee comes to the door from the time or even before they come to the door through whatever service they're receiving and going back home and the coordination that goes back home? How can we create incentives so that providers begin to redesign their systems? And what we found is if each managed care organization is pursuing its own quality objectives or goals, whatever those may be, that it becomes very difficult for providers. One plan wants diabetes measures and they want them reported quarterly in this way, and another plan wants a different diabetes measure reported monthly and they want it this way. And all of the different incentives and all of the different measures can become difficult for providers. The IHP is really intended as a way of being able to say, one, providers, you come forward and tell us how you think you can improve quality and how you can lower costs and help us work with you to be able to meet that objective. So it's still provider driven. And two, it's across the whole population. So again, across all of the managed care organizations, across fee-for-service. We still have challenges with our dual eligibles, those senior enrollees, to be able to figure out a way to be able to bring that population into the IHP because of the Medicare component and how do we share savings when there's Medicare payments involved. There are challenges with different subpopulations where just because there's so few people with a particular disease or condition and the cost is so high and so unpredictable that we have outliers within that. And so this is still, it's been successful. We're very proud of it, but it is still an experiment that's continuing to develop and continuing to evolve as we learn more.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I'm gonna go to Representative, I hope you can hear me because I'm having a little trouble with my connection, but I'm gonna go to Representative Bierman, but I just do wanna say, you know, kind of part what I read from your answer, Mr. Anderson, is, you know, we created a monster here. We've got many more plans that providers have to deal with. You said before there could be as many as four in a county. That's all our Medicaid program, four different plans that a provider has to work with. And then we've created something to try to tame the beast on top of it. That's kind of how I hear all of that. But anyway, I'm gonna go to Representative Bierman and then we'll move on to our next presenter. Representative Bierman. And I can't hear you. I think you're on mute.
Yeah, there we go.
There we go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Anderson, for the last response, really kind of pulled together a lot of the questioning I was having, so that was very good. It just seems to me that, you know, we improve what we measure, and you're measuring a lot of things here, and one of the measurements this committee certainly likes is the statement that there was $400 million in savings in this IHP plan, and so it seems to be working. But my question was, with all of that measuring and the amount of paperwork that the participants have to do. Have you had much pushback about the IHP being harder to apply and navigate and use for providers?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. We have, from the beginning of the IHP program, we have had a learning collaborative with IHPs, and that collaborative has been bidirectional. We learn from the providers, and hopefully the providers learn from us. More importantly, they learn from each other about ways that they can improve their care delivery, and we in our interactions with the providers are certainly trying to listen to concerns about any complexities with the program or challenges that they have. I will say, though, that one of the things that we hear consistently from almost every organization that participates in the IHP is that they get better data about their enrollees from DHS than they get from any managed care organization, commercial, public, whatever, that we have built a data portal for our IHPs so that they can be able to see their enrollees that they're serving and that they're that are attributed to them and that they're helping, so they can see and learn about their enrollees and their care needs. Again, I mentioned the virtual IHP in Northeast Minnesota that was a group of independent hospitals that early in their IHP process really discovered the amount of depression and anxiety within their patient population, not that was coming in to be hospitalized, not because that was the care that their providers were necessarily providing, but the amount of care and need that their population had and its correlation with emergency room visits and hospitalizations, and that if they could address the mental health needs of their population better, they could improve the quality of life for their enrollees and save costs. And so it's through, through this learning collaborative, through the data, and through exchanging with each other and learning from each other, that they are able to learn about that. We have been consistent with the organizations that have joined the IHP program. None of them have said we're stopping because this is too bureaucratic or it's too difficult. All of them have really wanted to continue the work, to be able to continue to learn from the data, to be able to serve their enrollees better, and to be able to find out better ways to deliver care.
And just a quick follow-up, and this is the last question, is so you termed it a pilot program. When will it not be a pilot any longer?
Mr. Anderson.
Well, I'm going to take, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'm going to use one of your jokes. The managed care organization, the managed care program in Medicaid in Minnesota is also a demonstration project. And that's been going on for, I don't know when it started, but decades now. So it is a demonstration project, both under state statute. The state statute that authorized us to be able to do this kind of activity was to be able to do, pilot projects or experiments, again, not mandatory for providers. And in our authorization with the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, this was built in as part of our state plan that we would be doing these demonstrations. We have the flexibility to end it. We have the ability to say this is not a permanent, this isn't a right that we have, and we can change it, we can stop it. As of right now, I would say we are still learning from it and we are still benefiting from it. So I would, just speaking personally, I would like to not see it stop, and I'd like to see us continue to improve. And as long as it's moving us in that direction, that we would continue to emphasize it and promote it and find ways to learn more. But there may come a time at which we say it is past the point where it's now, costing more than it's saving, or some other reform initiative has eclipsed it or whatever, and it's no longer functional.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Anderson. I have to say one thing, though. That is not a joke. That is the truth. It's still called demonstration projects. It is still a demonstration. And so, yes, but no, it is no joke, unfortunately, sadly. Mr. Gottwald, welcome to the committee. Thank you for your patience. And just so members may not know that Mr. Gottwald used to be in the legislature, and when I was a freshman, maybe, was the chair of, maybe later a little bit, but anyway, used to chair the Health Policy Committee, Health and Human Services Policy, I think it was, at that time. So welcome
back. We called it reform, I think, but it was the Policy Committee. You're correct.
Okay, very good.
Semantics, but.
Indeed. Well, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, and a compliment, if I may, to Assistant Commissioner Anderson. He has done some remarkable work. You'll hear about a county-based model here that is doing some excellent things. And Mr. Anderson has been working closely with us. And so it's not like this is all in silos. We're trying to work very much together to try to improve outcomes for people in need across our state who rely on us to do so. I'm going to expand here to our presentation mode. I hope you can see that all right. Unlike Mr. Anderson, I don't have somebody to advance slides for me, so I'm going to do it myself. But well, Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Steve Gottwald. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans. It is also known, some of you may hear the term county-based purchasing. It doesn't mean we're buying pencils and pens together or pads of paper. It is about purchasing as in procurement, as in delivering public programs in collaboration with the state of Minnesota and DHS. So this is very much part of what we're talking about here today. So again, models for delivering the public programs here in the state of Minnesota, as Mr. Anderson pointed out, we got DHS fee for service, where a provider provides and DHS on a fee schedule pays them. It's fee for the service. Then we have managed care, as we mentioned, with the MCOs. County-based purchasing plans are considered MCOs, but they're a very different animal, as we'll talk about. County-based purchasing I have listed separately here because it's administered and owned by local counties. That's a huge difference, and I'll explain a little further why that's important and why it brings particular value to serving people in need across our state. And then we heard a lot about integrated health partnerships, and they're really embedded by the Department of Human Services as a demonstration project in all of the above. So as we talk further about models for delivering Minnesota healthcare programs, all of these models have their place. Matt Anderson has pointed out from time to time that it's not one size fits all, and that's an important point to keep in mind. No one model fits every county in the state of Minnesota. And Minnesota and its counties, in fact, under state law, are called upon to collaboratively decide which of these models, either in combination or solely, best serves the people in each county. So the county-based purchasing model, the Department of Human Services contracts with counties, either individually or in joint powers, forming plans called county-based purchasing plans. And much like other MCOs, we manage and pay for all of the covered services. So there's no difference. We pay for the same benefits, provide the same benefits to residents enrolled in public programs. We accept the same risk, upside and downside, 100% risk under capitated rates that are determined by the Department of Human Services. That's real important to note. County-based purchasing doesn't get an added spiff or a different set of rules with regard to reimbursement. We get the same rates that DHS sets for all MCOs. We accept that reimbursement under the same DHS reimbursement methodology as HMOs, as I pointed out, and then we have to carry out all of the regulatory reporting and compliance requirements. This is a truly unique Minnesota model. California does a version of this. Oregon does a version of this. But Minnesota came up with this. It's over 40 years old. It's been a success for 40 years in Minnesota. Still a demonstration. We were talking about that a moment ago. In 1997, on a bipartisan basis, state legislature and the governor's office agreed to put in state law 256B.692, which provides special authority for counties and county-based purchasing when counties come together to do that, for the purpose of providing more dependable, locally focused, and accountable access for the public program enrollees. There had been concerns about plans being in and out of counties. Counties are stitched to their geography, and they're very passionate about serving the people in their jurisdiction. So when county-based purchasing models form, they care for the people in their counties. They're absolutely dedicated on a local basis with this local model. That's a very important difference. Organizationally, they integrate with County Health and Human Services, with social services, with all the other services counties provide. Those are all integrated with what we do for public program enrollees on the healthcare side. So there's kind of a value added perspective when you bring the counties into the picture. And that helps to effectively address social determinants of health and health equity. We know those are very important issues now. Hennepin Health, for those in the metro area, has a lot of the same attributes as county-based purchasing plans, although it's not technically considered a county-based purchasing plan. So we like to say county-based purchasing is not for every county, just as not every model is for every county in the state of Minnesota. Some counties have approached us and said, so is this a way for us to kind of cash in and have a little money we can use for other things in a county? It is not. The risk-reward trade-off is based on what the local community values and believes is going to work best for their vulnerable residents. So if they believe that by taking charge of this themselves and investing the significant amount of commitment and investment that it takes to do this in order to take care of their vulnerable residents, then they make that commitment. It's a very big commitment on the part of the counties. And again, it is not for every county. Not every county is prepared to do that or wants to do that. Madam Chair, this is a slide showing the counties that are currently involved. We have 22 counties across the state of Minnesota, rural counties right now, 11 more counties that are joining Prime West Health. We serve a little over 90,000 people right now in the state of Minnesota on public programs. And you can see there where the map lays out. So Prime West Health, the dark purple. We have Itasca County in the northern part of the state, the original county-based purchasing plan, and still doing great 40 years into this. South Country Health Alliance aligned mostly in the southern and southeastern portion of the state. So what do you get for county-based purchasing and what makes us unique? I'll move through this as quickly as I can, Madam Chair. I know we're tight for time. Obviously, public transparency and at a very local level. That's very different from other models. Public accountability. You know, county-based purchasing plans are owned and governed by the counties they serve. So they are governed by locally elected public officials. There are a few people that are more sensitive or passionate about serving people in need in their communities than county commissioners. Over on the Senate side, Madam Chair, we actually had a few county commissioners who stepped up at this point and kind of talked about that. Because of time, we weren't able to do this at this point. But if you talk to any of the county commissioners on our boards, you would hear passionate comments about how accountable, how innovative, how much they partner with providers in their local communities. It's really exciting and a very strong positive outcome. Social and civic responsibility. So this is neighbor caring for neighbor. This isn't some distant headquarters or plan delivering services in greater Minnesota. These are neighbors caring for neighbors right in their local communities. You have an economy of scale, as I mentioned earlier. You're taking the state program and contracting with counties who then add to that everything the counties bring to the table in serving people in need in those communities. And then we leverage public-private partnerships. So we're bringing people together at a local level, and we're bringing together both private healthcare and human services resources. No one service sector doing it alone. We bring them together. Integration, again. We bring together the county services of all kinds together with the county health services in an entire healthcare continuum, right? We talk about outcomes. We talk about serving the broad needs of people in need. We're doing that in a very local, integrated way. A local convener, as I mentioned. So here we've got county commissioners, a county healthcare plan that is bringing together local providers. So for example, if dental care is a big issue in a particular area, and it is in a lot of rural Minnesota, these county commissioners, these county plans are sitting down with local dental providers and saying, how can we do this better? Can you help us? If we partner with you, will you do a better job of serving Medicaid recipients, for example? And we have numerous specific examples of county-based purchasing doing exactly that. The value added, as I mentioned, we're adding to what communities bring to the table and then convening that. And innovation. So you got unique local needs that are driving unique and replicable solutions that bring about what? Better health, fuller life, health equity, and lower costs. And if you notice, those are the same things that Commissioner Harpstead emphasizes, and rightly so, in her comments about what DHS wants to accomplish. So preserving the CBP model, we think it's important to keep. Again, we don't say it's one size fits all, but this is a very, very important model for the state of Minnesota. State law, Chapter 256B.692, calls for counties and the Department of Human Services to work much more closely together. And it gives counties unique authority in deciding who serves the people in need in their counties. So that law needs to be fully implemented. It still is not. We've heard concerns that CMS may or may not be okay with this model, but the law calls for federal waivers to be sought, and that has not happened yet. So we are working with DHS to try to fully implement this yet. Upholding county authority. I mentioned that counties have unique authority in state law to decide who is delivering this care to the people in their communities. We think it's very important that that continue. And then resisting benefits carve-outs. We hear proposals for carving out dental, for carving out pharmacy, for carving out emergency medical transportation or non-emergency medical transportation. These fragment healthcare. And while they might make sense in a short term, or somebody says they save some money here or there, they tend to break up the way we deliver healthcare and make it more difficult for us to do a good job in an integrated way for the people we serve. Madam Chair, I'm going to wrap it up there, and perhaps we could open it up to questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Gottwald. We appreciate your presentation. We do have a couple questions. I'm going to ask for these to be really quick because we do have one presenter still, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be very brief and quick on this. So I like this program just mainly because it really sticks out that local control. And I do believe in rural Minnesota, and my experience in the past has been in rural Minnesota with healthcare, that this is what we need, more innovation like this. The providers that have called me about this are real happy with this program. And, you know, it's different because they actually collect a little bit more payment here, and they're able to cost shift that to the unimbursed care that they are not getting paid for. So I think this is a great program, and I would like to see us support it to continue along and watch it grow.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hewitt. Mr. Gottwald, can you stop sharing the screen so we can see
absolutely.
Other members?
Yeah, let me do that.
Okay, Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and members. You know, I want to say, like the representative just said here, is county-based programs. If you look on the map, I serve seven counties. Six of the seven counties are in it. And, you know, one thing I like about them is they drive savings, not just working with local providers. You know, I know IHPs have done well, but they generally drive their savings through reimbursement cuts, where county-based program works with the local providers. They work with the local community. You'll be surprised. I mean, I get a lot of calls dealing with this on the great level of care my constituents get, how the county is involved with it. It is one of those, PriWest is one of the boards that county members want to serve on because they know they can provide care. And then if PriWest has extra money, they then invest that into the community, a lot of times with preventative care and so forth. So just a strong, very strong supporter of it. I do believe that DHS should look at implementing it throughout the state, like the law said about 40 years ago. Would encourage, and I would be very happy to work on that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Backer. And yeah, I'm with you. Absolutely. I agree. I know this has a lot of support in this legislature. So yeah, okay. So we're going to move along and give Mr. Andreessen a few minutes. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam
Chair
and members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gottwald. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair, do you see my screen?
We can, yeah.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Appreciate having a few minutes here to talk about managed care organizations here in Minnesota. And I'll try not to be redundant, but I apologize if I am during my presentation. I think everyone involved in this process shares the belief that Minnesotans served by public programs deserve a stable and reliable access to services no matter where they're enrolled. And this is definitely a goal of our members who participate and manage in healthcare programs, and those are the ones listed here below. And I just want to point out that these are all Minnesota-based nonprofit organizations. They're all headquartered here, so these are Minnesota companies. Managed care organizations, or they're also called MCOs, are organizations that are certified by the Department of Health to provide all defined healthcare benefits to people enrolled in public programs for, as you've heard, a capitated rate. This all started in 1985, and state moved to a managed care model in due to large part to the wild fluctuations in Medicaid costs and the problems that have been arising with providers unwilling to see Medicaid enrollees. Several council members have been a part of the successful partnership for the state ever since and have expanded this partnership to hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans. Many states have adopted this similar managed care model for their managed Medicaid programs, and Minnesota has become a national leader in managed care. Now, as you heard, the managed care model is a partnership and a collaboration between the state and the MCOs. And so in this partnership, the state and the MCOs play different roles. With the state, they're the ones deciding the services and treatments that are covered, decides who's eligible, and then helps with the enrollment for those members. And then they also, as we've heard, pay for a set amount per person of those covered services. With MCOs, they work with providers, pharmacists, and community services for the access to care, so it's very similar to commercial insurance, but also manage the delivery of services as well as other additional benefits that I'll touch on here in a few minutes. Now, much of this is determined through the procurement process, as you heard, which is that competitive bidding process. And the goal is to make sure that whoever is bidding is awarded contracts to plans that can best serve that value. And the council fully supports those policies that encourage competition and create a level playing field for everyone to get the best value for Minnesotans. So I want to touch on a couple of benefits that managed care brings to the state. And the first is managed care provides financial predictability. MCOs accept a predetermined per member rate, and that's for the locked in for that contract. Now this helps the state with certainty during the budget making process when DHS sets its budget and the legislature appropriates money for the Medicaid program. Second, the benefit of managed care is having MCOs assume the financial risk of covering healthcare costs. Healthcare utilization can fluctuate, and in turn, that fluctuates the cost of the program. So by using a managed care system, the MCO takes on that financial responsibility. And so if enrollee costs go up, exceeding state payments, the plans then pay that difference. Now, the inverse can also happen when costs are lower than projected, and this is why MCOs must adhere to a medical loss ratio. So this means that if an MCO doesn't devote 85% of the money allocated to them for healthcare expenses, that money then gets returned to the state. Now, additionally, MCOs are part of companies that must meet solvency and soundness standards and hold reserves in case that there's a significant increase in healthcare demand. Now, Minnesota has faced situations where other entities in the managed care space have faced financial challenges and had to withdraw from managed care contracts due to solvency concerns. Having ample reserves is a key part of making sure that the health plan operating as an MCO is organized to support enrollees through thick and thin. And lastly, MCOs provide access to high quality care. Ultimately, it's about access to care for Minnesotans in these programs, and our council members have come through in that commitment. Quality is a key component of MCO services, and our members must meet rigorous NCQA accreditation standards. Council members are constantly evaluating how to make meaningful improvements and advance high quality care and reduce health disparities for communities of color. Now, as I mentioned, the work of MCOs is not just about paying claims. Every day, MCOs are ensuring that people get into their appointments, arrange rides to their facilities, coordinate medical care and community-based services, spot gaps in care, and create predictability for about 900,000 Minnesotans. Council MCOs offer unique capabilities that all organizations can provide, such as financial structures, medical knowledge, administrative know-how, and existing relationships with doctors and those who provide care. MCOs have a broad network of providers and tools to help enrollees find the best care for their needs in the state. And that coordinated care is led by MCOs results in higher quality and better outcomes. This also includes the use of telehealth, with MCOs have fully implemented so people can receive the health care they need when they need it. It's also important to note a significant portion of the Medicaid population, as you heard, are seniors and Minnesotans living with disabilities. Care coordination is key for these populations, and MCOs have established programs to fill in those gaps so enrollees are not missing out on care or facing duplicative care. MCOs also work on issues to help remove social barriers, such as the lack of stable housing and social isolation and food insecurity. Some of that work includes identifying conditions and communities that impact people's health, funding food vouchers to help people get the food they need in their local supermarkets, and connecting children with specialized services and early child home visits for low-income families. Now, as Commissioner Anderson mentioned, this partnership is, it's about accountability. Throughout the year, our MCOs meet with DHS to ensure that we're following the rules set by state and federal government, and also meeting the goals set forth in the MCO contracts. MCOs are regularly audited for financial accountability, and these reports, along with the MCO contracts, are publicly posted on MDH and DHS websites. Our contact information for the council is below. Our members want to serve as a resource to you and the agencies, and we all strive to provide Minnesotans with access to high-quality care at the best value. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Andreessen, thank you for that. And that was a nice, concise presentation. We appreciate that. Are there questions from members? I'm not seeing any. Maybe members are all kind of all questioned out for this time. I have one, and let me ask this one and then we can go to Representative Gruenhagen. So Mr. Andreessen, I probably could have asked this of any of the other testifiers, but it's around the question of risk bearing. So over my career, sometimes people talk about MCOs taking the risk, and sometimes they say MCOs don't take the risk. And I think there's a little tension there, because we know that the rates have to be, by under federal law, actuarially sound. So for example, if we give an MCO a rate for the next year, and then you lose money on it, then the next year that we would be increasing the rate to make up for that underpayment in the previous year. So in that respect, because the state is kind of making it up or cutting back as we go year to year, there's a sense in which people believe that the MCOs are not really bearing risk. So I'd just like to have you comment on this, if you would. It's kind of the eternal question. Are MCOs bearing risk or not?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I would say is that they are. When you say about setting rates for the future year, they can't look backwards. They need to look forward. So it's a projection as to what healthcare costs will be in the future. And I think that kind of goes back to Commissioner Anderson's comments, where they're trying to figure out where things are going to be here as we go forward, because there is a lot of uncertainty as to what future healthcare costs would be. So that's what I'd say in regard to that, is that it's looking forward, not backwards.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Madam, Anderson, please.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to address that. So in the managed care contracts and the arrangements that we have, the argument that I would make is that managed care organizations do bear financial risk. And when we do our actuarial analysis and set actuarially sound rates, we are looking at the actuarial analysis of the enrollee population together, not by plan. And so when plans get their contracts and they get their capitation rates as a result of that, they may have more enrollees than they expected. They may have less enrollees than they expected. They may have higher spending than they expected. We take that into account the next year. But if you were a plan, if there's three plans in a county, and we look at all the enrollees in that county and we set the rates accordingly, if one plan exceeded spending, it doesn't get that spending back. And if another plan was below spending, it keeps the amount outside of its, unless it exceeds its medical loss ratio, it keeps that amount. And the next year, its rates are, again, as we look at the population as a whole, it has an advantage because it's already been able to deliver its services cheaper than its competitors and will continue to advantage by that. So each plan in a given year has a risk of losing money. And the next year's rates, while the overall utilization may have gone up and its experience will be taken into account, its experience is not taken account back into its own rates. Okay. And so from that perspective, they do have risk.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I'm going to move on quickly here because we have 5 minutes left and we've got two members who want to ask questions. So Grunhagen and then Pryor. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a question. Do you have comparative data with other states as far as per participant, if you're below or above or similar to other MCOs in other states? Do you have that type of data?
Mr. Andreessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, not at the moment. I can see what I can find for you, but maybe if you wouldn't mind, Madam Chair, maybe get back to the idea of reimbursement payments. I know that has come up, and maybe that's kind of the question here, is that, there's a question about it being public. And what I would say is that, yes, it's true that that data is provided to DHS, and it's true that it's not publicly available. But there's a reason for that, and it's because if you have two providers, you have one provider who is making their quality improvement measurements, they're having great outcomes with their patients, they may be set at a certain reimbursement rate. Or you might have a second one who is in the same practice or kind of area of discipline where their quality outcome is less and their patients aren't doing well, that might be a lower rate. Well, if everybody knew what everyone was getting paid, the second provider will say, well, I want this rate the same person that other person got. So now you have people at the same rate, but you're also paying the same for different outcomes. And so that's okay. Kind of part of the reason why some of this is private data.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go to Representative Pryor.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, if you could kind of benchmark us what's happened in this last year. Because people have been deferring a lot of health basic health care. And so, you hear, so they're not being, so providers lost out on that business, but then also the insurance company, the rates, their things are probably, are they still below rates? So I know that we'll probably be hearing about this a lot in the future, how this last year or this year and a half, how it continues to be different. But can we get a sense of what happened?
Yeah, and we've only got 2 minutes, Mr. Andreessen, so really briefly, if you could.
Yep. Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, so yes, it's true, there's been lower utilization because of this, and you may have seen this in some of the budget documents that DHS was projecting, some money coming back because of lower utilization and not meeting MLRs. I think it was 17 million off the top of my head. I think the question going forward is what happens to this delayed care, because at some point people were putting off procedures and they're going to come back. And so that's the question, is when do we see these patients coming back in?
Okay, follow up, Representative Pryor. We've got one more minute.
Well, just to say, yeah, and then when they're coming because of delayed care, they'll probably be coming back in sicker and more complicated health issues.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you very much to our presenters. It's been, at least to me, very interesting. And I hope members have learned a lot. And, after all, we are responsible for this $5 billion a year expenditure at the end of the day. I know that'll taunt your dreams, I know. But thank you very much for your attention. And tomorrow we will be hearing about local public health. We're hearing a bill on local public health. And then we're hearing from Dr. Michael Osterholm, who's going to talk to us about his view of the pandemic. So should be a very interesting presentation tomorrow as well. So with that, thank you, members. We are adjourned.